From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point with U.S. Ambassador Paul Bremer preparing to formally hand over the keys to post-Saddam Iraq by the end of June. The shape of an Iraqi democracy is still very much up in the air, and large questions remain about whether either country will be ready for the handover. Tonight on Point, getting under the covers in Iraq to ask what's really going on with the U.S. occupation and plans for handover. We begin in Baghdad. White House and Pentagon hopes for a smooth, formal transition in Iraq face serious hurdles as Iraq's most influential Shiite cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, has raised a call for direct elections rather than U.S.-planned regional caucuses. This has delayed the drafting of an interim constitution and created a split in the Iraqi governing council. I asked Mike Hirsch, a senior editor at Newsweek based in Baghdad, how likely it is that there will be direct elections in Iraq before the scheduled June 30th handover of sovereignty.
I think that what is being negotiated now, or what is going to be negotiated over the next several weeks, may involve a compromise between something like what the Ayatollah Sistani has asked for, national direct elections, and what the Americans had wanted to do after the November 15th agreement for a new transitional assembly, which were caucuses of elites in each of Iraq's 18 governorates. And among the compromise proposals being discussed are possibility of referendums in local Shiite areas that would feel much more like elections, whereas other regions might have something that resembled caucuses. It's all yet to be decided, but from everything I'm hearing here from sources, there's a lot of middle ground still to be negotiated.
Headline in the New York Times today, U.S. plans for Iraq imperiled. Do things seem imperiled there, or are you suggesting that a negotiated way out of this looks like a real possibility?
I don't think it's quite so imperiled that it's all going to fall apart and something like civil war and disaster will ensue. What's happened here essentially is that Sistani, who it turns out is perhaps the most powerful person in Iraq, has, again, called for direct elections, defied the Americans, caused the Bush administration to completely rethink its plan. But at the same time, he has indicated that he's willing to find some kind of a solution that would involve the United Nations and some kind of an affirmation by a UN special team coming in here that indeed, as the Americans are saying, direct elections are simply not possible now for a whole host of reasons. Because of Iraq's history as a totalitarian dictatorship, there's no voter registration, there hasn't been a national census done in a long time, and therefore it simply is not feasible to conduct legitimate elections in that way. What many of us believe, talking to people here in Baghdad, is that if Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, goes ahead and says in some weeks from now that indeed we cannot conduct these elections, that Sistani will probably agree to that, and there could be some kind of proposal. So there is a lot of room for negotiation.
Mike, there's clearly a direct interest in the legitimacy that an election might bring, but it also seems that this has become a kind of political football. What are the politics surrounding the debate over this election? Even the Pentagon's favorite, at least at one time, man in Iraq, Ahmed Chalabi, has come out in favor of elections. How's this being spun? How's it being played?
Well, smart politics anywhere around the world these days involve anti-Americanism. That's an unfortunate reality that Americans have to stomach. One of the reasons that Sistani has been such a successful politician in these recent weeks is that he has distanced himself from the Americans in a way that those on the governing council, like Chalabi, did not. He has refused to meet with the Iraq administrator, Jerry Bremer, here, and that has played very well to the Iraqi people who resent the occupation. So what you're seeing now is those on the governing council who align themselves with the Americans but realize they've been deeply unpopular as a result are using this opportunity to distance themselves, to kind of play the Sistani game of appearing to defy the Americans because that plays well here at home in Iraq. You know, that's essentially what you're seeing in people like Chalabi, who is deeply, deeply unpopular here and needs to do whatever he can to win some credibility with the Iraqi people.
In the meantime, there's supposed to be an interim constitution drafted by next month, February. Is that on track, Mike Hirsch?
No, I mean, nothing is really on track here. That is as much in dispute as the elections almost. One of the key issues is what will happen to the Kurds. The Kurds are holding out for a plan to expand their semi-autonomous region in the north beyond what they had under Saddam. They want to include oil-rich cities like Kirkuk, which are not traditionally part of Kurdistan, and any number of other issues, you know, right down to human rights and women's rights have yet to be resolved. So it's all in a state of, you know, a great big rush to try to finish this, to resolve the elections issue, to get to the point where they can still somehow have a transitional assembly by the end of May, which is slated to accept the handover of sovereignty from the Americans by June 30th.
Mike Hirsch, let me just ask you a big, broad question. Sitting there looking out on Iraq as you are Iraqis going to be ready for a credible, workable handover of sovereignty by this summer?
Well, I mean, that is, you know, the $64,000 question, and it really depends on how you frame it. When you say, are they ready, does it mean that we're going to have a model democracy by July 1st? No, there's no chance of that. But does it mean, on the other hand, that once the Americans bow out, once Paul Bremer returns to the United States and we end up with what is planned, which is a kind of a super embassy, an unusually powerful ambassador, but nothing more, and the coalition provisional authority disappears, does it mean that civil war is going to ensue immediately afterwards? Well, it doesn't quite mean that either. I think what you're likely to have is a very messy situation for a long time. One of the perils that the Iraqis are facing down the line after the Americans leave is that there isn't any kind of a single unifying leader, as we had, for example, in Afghanistan with Hamid Karzai, who can be seen as someone that the entire country can cotton to. And that is a problem. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, Ayatollah Sistani is such an interesting figure right now, because he is indeed perhaps the only national figure at this point, even though he is a Shiite, who can keep the peace.
Mike Hirsch, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mike Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek. He spoke with me from Baghdad. So the United States is scheduled to hand over authority in Iraq in just 5 months. Right now, the security situation is tenuous. The country's ethnic and religious divisions are sharply evident, and Iraqis are arguing about what it will take for any new government to win legitimacy. Beyond the politics, there is the question of whether post-Saddam Iraq has found the infrastructure, the social institutions, the basic security to stand on its own two feet. Tonight on Point, looking under the covers in Iraq, from halfway around the world, can you tell if Iraq is drifting toward chaos or finding its way? Does Iraq look like a country that is ready to run its own show? Is the White House view too rosy? Is the press picture too grim? With 100,000-plus U.S. troops still to be on the ground in Iraq, can June's planned transfer of power be for real? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Palo Alto, California, is Bill Evers. He served as senior advisor for education to Ambassador Paul Bremer from July through December last year, and as education policy advisor to the Bush presidential campaign of 2000. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Good evening and welcome, Bill Evers.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from New York City is George Packer, writer for The New Yorker magazine. His November 24th piece, entitled War After War, What Washington Doesn't See in Iraq, detailed the difficulties of rebuilding Iraq as a post-Saddam democracy. Good evening and welcome, George Packer.
Good to be here.
Good to have you, George. Bill Evers, you're just back something like a month now from Iraq. You spent 5 months in the thick of things there, helping rebuild the education system. Give us a sense of what your task was. What exactly were you up to?
I worked every day trying to see that schools got rehabilitated, that children were in classrooms, that they had teachers and textbooks, and to try to help the Iraqis who were working on this, especially in the later time period, to be a kind of liaison between the American bureaucracy and the Iraqi bureaucracy.
So you saw it through the lens of the education system.
Yes.
And we know from what you've written that you felt pretty good about that system. We want to hear more about that. But step back for a moment with us, Bill Evers. What is your sense overall of how things are going there? Do you see Iraq as on track to effectively receive this transfer of power this summer, end of June, and run with it?
I do. But I also read, while I was over there, George Packer's piece in The New Yorker, and I thought it did a good job of suggesting some of the problems that are there, too.
George Packer, how about it? I'm not sure exactly when you got back. You saw a lot that was going on in the post-Saddam period last summer. Have you kept up? And what do you think? Do Americans have a clear picture of what's unfolding in Iraq? Do you think it's unfolding in a way people can be comfortable with?
I've tried to keep up. I certainly haven't been there as recently as Mr. Evers has. One thing I learned, maybe the first thing I learned in Iraq, was not to be categorical, to remain open to the possibility that it won't simply be one thing or another. We all wanted to say either yes, it's working, or no, it's not. Journalists were constantly talking to each other about that and talking to CPA officials like Bill Evers and others. Mm-hmm. But I think it's not the best category to apply. Yes or no, it's gonna work out or it isn't. It's messy, as Mike Hirsch said. I think he gave an excellent account of the state of things politically right now. It'll continue to be messy. One thing that strikes me is that with every day, it seems to be less and less under the control or influence of the American authorities, and Iraqi politics is beginning to assert itself more and more. And I think as we move toward June 30th, actually really from the November 15th agreement on, that made the CPA a lame duck occupation authority with a deadline. And ever since then, I think more and more as we get to June 30th, it will be more an Iraqi show, for better and for worse.
Bill Evers, hone in for a moment, if you will, for us on education, which you looked at just as one slice of the pie, and there's a lot more to talk about. But are Iraqi school children back in school? Do they have textbooks and teachers and glass in the windows? And are they getting an education?
Well, I think they're getting an education. There's always room for improvement, and I would agree with Mr. Packer that it's messy. It's not all one, and it's not all another. In the case of the ministries, which take a lot of the life of Iraq, is actually historically under government control, and that hasn't completely changed. The changeover really began in early September, when ministers were appointed, and the CPA officials really became advisors to those ministers. And we, in the case of education, had a medical doctor who had a lot of experience in education take charge. He began running the ministry on a day-to-day basis. You could tell immediately that all the people were paying attention to and hanging on his words and no longer paying as much attention to me, and that was fine. And I think that George Packer is correct that increasingly it's becoming an Iraqi show, but that's to the good. I mean,
so it's becoming an Iraqi show.
That is really what one would want.
We hear that, but give us, and we don't want to be categorical yet. We're trying to be more narrow here with you. If we just look at education, a simple question: what do we have any idea? Do you what percentage of Iraqi children are in school, and are they being, you know, what would commonly be seen as educated, or is there still I don't know, kids running around the streets and no school to go to?
Well, kids are running around the streets, and they were before this. But in terms of a sample of schools that were looked at to see how closely attendance matched pre-war times or matched March and April as opposed to September, it looks as if attendance is at about 95% to 97% of what it was pre-war. Now, that does not mean that pre-war everyone was going to school under the Saddam government, because the country had become so impoverished in the last decade. A lot of children were not attending school.
We don't want to be categorical tonight, but we do want to try and figure out whether this, on balance, is a country that can run after a transfer of power. George Packer, Bill Evers, please stand by. We're going to hear after the break from Paul Bremer's spokesman in Baghdad. We're getting under the covers in Iraq this hour, asking what's really going on there just 5 months before the scheduled handover of sovereignty to Iraqis. You can join our conversation tonight from halfway around the world. Can you tell if Iraq is headed into chaos or finding its feet? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting under the covers in Iraq tonight, asking what's really going on there just 5 months before the scheduled handover of sovereignty to Iraqis. My guest tonight, New Yorker magazine writer George Packer, who spent a lot of time in Iraq and came back with a great big piece on what it looked like was working and what was not there. Joining us from Palo Alto, California, Bill Evers. He was senior advisor for education to Ambassador Paul Bremer from July through December of last year. You can join our conversation tonight as well. Is this a country that looks ready to run its own show 5 months from now? Will the world see a United States that has succeeded in Iraq, or that has cut and run, or that is still steering from behind the scenes? And might President Bush yet be able to credibly claim mission accomplished before the November election? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Earlier, I spoke with Dan Senor, spokesman for Ambassador Paul Bremer in Baghdad. I want to invite my guests and you to listen in on that conversation and then share reactions, Bill and George, with the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani sticking to his demand for direct elections instead of U.S.-planned Iraqi caucuses. I asked Dan Senor if there is room for a compromise.
We as Americans are for direct elections. We think direct elections are a good thing. We certainly have had experience with them for the last some 200 years. And in fact, in the political agreement the coalition reached with the governing council, it has three direct elections built into it next year alone. The direct election of the drafters to the Iraqi Constitutional Convention, the direct election for the referendum of that constitution that comes out of the Constitutional Convention, and then the direct election of a government at the end of 2005 for the new permanent government, we call it, to take office in 2006. The challenge for us over the next few months is whether or not, as much as we'd like to do direct elections in the next few months, whether or not there's enough electoral infrastructure in this country in order to create and accomplish fair and legitimate elections. There are no constituent boundaries in this country. There hasn't been a census in this country for some 20 years. There are no voter rolls. There are no political party laws. And it's important, if these elections are to be fair and legitimate, that we take a serious look about whether or not direct elections are possible.
All of this may sound very persuasive to an American audience accustomed to all those things, but there on the ground you have this very important Shiite leader, Sistani, saying he wants them anyway. So the question stands, is there room for compromise, something between direct elections and the caucuses that you've planned so far, Dan Senor?
Well, we have asked the UN to take a look at this issue, and we have said a couple of things. One, are direct elections possible in the next few months? If yes, then tell us how to proceed, how they envision them. Make a recommendation. Do some analysis. The UN has a lot of experience in this area. If no, tell us the alternative. I'd rather not prejudge the outcome of that process and speculate. We've asked the UN to consider the request. The Iraqi Governing Council has asked the UN to take a look at this. I'd like to let that process play out.
Six more American soldiers killed over the weekend and a couple of dozen Iraqis, at least the interior minister there, Nouri Badran, said today that he'd like to see the whole matter postponed until the security situation is brought under control. Is the security situation in Iraq itself an impediment to stepping ahead with the transfer of sovereignty this summer, Dan?
Our sense now is that there are two strategies to defeating the terrorists that are coming in from foreign countries and the insurgents that are organizing against the new Iraq. One strategy is the military strategy, which we are executing quite effectively. Our troops are on the offensive. We are capturing or killing the insurgents and the rank-and-file members that are killing innocent Iraqis. So that process is moving along. But there's an equally important strategy that almost has to be dual-tracked. And that strategy is the political and economic empowerment of regular Iraqis. Because the more power we hand over to Iraqis, both economic power and political power, for them to manage their own lives and run their day-to-day living and day-to-day government and allow them to wind down the occupation, the more we empower them and isolate the terrorists and isolate the insurgents. So it's critical that we move forward doing what we're doing. It is part of the effort to defeat the terrorists. It is part of the effort to defeat the insurgents.
But how's it going? There's still plenty of blood running.
Yeah.
Will there be sufficient security for an orderly handover?
Sadly, the violence will continue. I mean, it definitely has come down. We have tragic events like the ones you cited, and certainly any day an American soldier's life is lost is dreadful. This is the price we pay for being right now in Iraq in what is the central front in the war on terrorism. But let's be clear, there will be more violence between now and the June 30th handover of sovereignty. And that's because as those who are trying to undermine the new Iraq, those enemies of freedom, as they realize that it's real, we are handing over more and more authority to Iraqis every day, as they realize we're handing more and more power over to Iraqis every day, that in just a matter of time, the president's vision for a democratic, sovereign, independent Iraq, at peace with itself and at peace with the world, once they realize that that's just around the corner, they're going to do everything they can to undermine it. The stakes will get high. There will sadly be more violence. But we have to stay the course, as President Bush has said. The stakes are far too high.
And what will the country be that the U.S. occupation will be handing over? In infrastructure terms, what shape will Iraq be in?
Well, look, this country, this economy has suffered from 35 years of chronic underinvestment by the former regime. You have electrical power plants relying on generators from the 1950s. You have oil production facilities relying on equipment and boilers from the 1960s. We visited Basra not long ago, went to a children's hospital, saw children in incubators from the late 1970s, early 1980s. There was zero investment in basic infrastructure in this country, while Saddam invested most of the country's resources in palaces and monuments to the regime and obviously a very aggressive military program. That's going to take time. You don't fix that overnight. You don't fix it in 3 months or 9 months or 12 months. And when we end the civilian occupation, when we end the political occupation and hand over sovereignty to the Iraqis, there's still going to be a lot of work to do on the infrastructure side. And that's why it's very important that Congress and the president signed into law an appropriations bill to invest $18.6 billion in Iraq to redo this infrastructure. Electricity is the priority. Potable water is the next priority. Basic, you know, sewage infrastructure being repaired is a key priority. And this is going to go on for the next couple of years. We're putting in about twice as much as Iraq's GDP right now. We'll be putting in, you know, almost $19 billion over the next several years.
Of course, that GDP isn't much, but that's still a lot of money. Last question, Dan. So June 30th is the target handover date. Is your boss, Paul Bremer, coming home on July 1st one way or another?
Well, he has said that he will stay until the job is finished, until the mission is complete. And that means that he is working himself out of a job right now because the plan is to hand over sovereignty on July 1, and then he said he's going to retire to Vermont.
Dan Senor, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Dan Senor, spokesman for Ambassador Paul Bremer. He spoke with me from Baghdad. I'm joined tonight by Bill Evers. He was Paul Bremer's senior advisor for education until late December. And by George Packer, a New Yorker magazine journalist who spent a lot of time in Iraq. George Packer, when you listen to the spokesperson's general picture of Iraq, does this sound realistic to you?
Well, one thing that struck me about what Dan Senor said was he gave a lot of technical reasons why elections are really unfeasible, except maybe in some local areas between now and June 30th. But one thing you never hear American officials saying on the record is that elections might have an extremely negative effect on the shape of Iraqi politics going into sovereignty and self-rule. And we saw this in Bosnia. We've seen it in a number of post-conflict situations where if elections are held immediately, it's always the most extreme groups that win. And it sets in place a dynamic of polarization and really of conflict.
And why would the most extreme
which can be extremely destructive.
Why would the most extreme groups win, George? Don't most Iraqis presumably want some kind of normalcy?
Because they're the most organized, and some of them have militias, and they have credibility. I mean, the leaders who, for example, in the Shiite community, not necessarily extremists like Muqtada al-Sadr, but certainly militias like the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. We don't really know exactly what kind of Iraq they want, but they scare secular, moderate, liberal-minded Iraqis in the cities like Baghdad and Kirkuk because they are coming from a sectarian Shiite background. But they have the most credibility in the Shiite community. If there were an election held today, I'm certain that the leaders from those tendencies would win. And the people who have been left out of the political equation are the moderates, the very people that we would want to empower most and that we've somehow failed to find and organize and empower. And so if elections are held in the next few months, this is something I think American officials understand but really can't say because it goes against the correct idea that elections are always a good thing. If they were held in the next few months, it would set in place a government that I think is going to be more extreme and more polarized and perhaps less democratic than if sovereignty precedes elections, and then something like what's happened in Afghanistan happens in Iraq. If Afghanistan, in a way, presents a model which has not been followed in Iraq, and I think Afghanistan is probably a better model.
Bill Evers, take us into the councils of power there in Baghdad, where you spent a lot of time. What is the attitude about direct elections? Sistani kind of shook everybody up when he called for them. Shiites are 60%, maybe more, of Iraq's population. They would clearly swing a lot of influence in those elections. Is there any circumstance under which you can imagine Paul Bremer saying yes to direct elections? Does he fear that that would lead into this kind of further division that George Packer describes?
Well, I think the main concern is to try to create a pluralistic constitutional democracy in Iraq. And although there's a lot of maneuvering going on, it's not just Sistani. They're also, in addition to the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, there's the Dawa Party. There are other prominent players among the Shiites. The Kurds are maneuvering. There's a lot of jockeying going on, but actually everybody's doing it within the context of wanting a pluralistic constitutional democracy. So even though there are disagreements, and even though the exact plan that an American official may have come up with at some point to transition may be having its problems at the moment, that doesn't mean that it's off track in terms of the larger project of a new and different Iraq.
Well, but this is kind of right in the teeth of what George Packer just said. You trust then that, for example, Ayatollah al-Sistani wants that pluralistic democracy, though the Sunnis and the Kurds seem to have some question about that. Even Americans have raised some concern. I mean, he is originally Iranian. There's a Shiite Iranian government right across the border. Are you so confident that Sistani himself, who seems to swing a lot of influence, is committed to a pluralistic democracy in Iraq?
Well, I don't know every detail of his views, but I've read a lot, and I've followed these different Shiite positions, and the Iraqi Shiites have a different view about politics from the Iranian Shiites. The Iranians have the idea that top juridical scholars, top legal scholars who are Islamic scholars, should be running the country. And the Iraqi Shiites have a quite different view, which is they can advise, they can give their opinions, they can be objects of emulation and copying and good examples, but they shouldn't enter into government, they shouldn't be running the country.
Right.
So I think, and I know Mr. Packard is a very wise man about all these issues, and I think he would concur with me. So that doesn't mean things will be perfect and smooth and there will be no friction and disagreements, but I think it gives a much better prospect for the success of a pluralistic constitutional society than the Iranians. The actual the hope in Iran is that enough of the society has experienced the negative side of a theocratic dictatorship that they are now beginning to be ready for a more
pluralistic. And we hear that chafing there. George Packer, I hear you.
Yeah. I think what a greater danger than Iranian-style theocracy is simply a power struggle among the three major groups, each of whom feels that their own rights are in danger of being taken away and their interests are jeopardized. And if the groups begin to feel that it really is a zero-sum game in which they have to strive for the greatest gains to grab the most power they can, or else they're going to be somehow endangered by the other groups, then theocracy isn't really the problem. The problem is power. And unfortunately, there's very little in Iraqi history to convince them otherwise. In other words, I
agree with Mr. Packard. There is a terrible problem, not just in Iraq, but in other Arab Middle Eastern countries, where people do see politics as a zero-sum game.
And yet that's where we are. That's where the U.S. has planted its flag to say we're going to try and plant democracy here.
But I also think let's take one possible optimistic side to this.
Sure.
And that is they've just lived through a horrible dictatorship, a fascist dictatorship, a cruel, brutal dictatorship, and they don't want to have that again.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible that part of this will be, and Tom Friedman is, you know, I don't necessarily agree with him on everything, and I don't want to give some kind of blanket endorsement, but he said, look, a lot of these people, these political actors in Iraq, may come to the position as time approaches to set up the interim constitution and the ultimate constitution, mm-hmm. that they have to step back, make compromises. They have to figure out exactly how strong the federalism is going to be, exactly what strength of freedom of religion there is, so that both the Shiites and Sunnis can have their place in the society.
And then decide whether they want to buy in.
Mm. And it's not unreasonable, given their experience, that they might do this. And one cause for hope is to look at Lebanon. Now, you know, the horrible possibility is something like the 1975 Lebanese Civil War. But another way to look at it is Lebanon has really come back from that. And in a certain sense, what's going on in Iraq now is people are jockeying to try to figure out how to make a classic Lebanese solution in Iraq, which gives certain authority, certain separate communal power, certain dividing up of offices.
All right, we've watched that. But, of course, Tom Friedman at the New York Times has also been very critical of the rebuilding effort in Iraq. I want to get at least one call in before the break here. Bill Evers, George Packer, if you'll permit me. John's calling from Stanton, Kentucky. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Truly. Hi. I'm actually a Catholic priest, and I've worked in community development for, 25 years. I understand what community process is like.
So what do you see in Iraq, John?
The problem is, once we're there, and it was certainly questionable as to going into Iraq with military means, once we're there, we have a moral responsibility to keep the order. But is the pulling out of the U.S. troops and Daesh on a timetable with the United States' timetable, handing over political responsibility to the Iraqis, is that occasioned by a presidential election decision, meaning if they don't get out, George W. Bush is not going to get reelected? And is the Bush administration willing to lose the election for justice's sake if postponing independence for the Iraqi people would take a longer time?
It's a great question, John. Thank you for calling. George Packer, how about it? Is this time, June 30th, driven by any internal logic in Iraq, or is it fairly fully driven by the Bush reelection timetable?
My guess is both. I think there were a lot of reasons to think that an indefinite occupation was untenable, and Iraqis were chafing under it every day, and Americans were dying every day and still are, and no one liked the status quo. But I think at the same time, it's inevitable that politics is going to play a role, and during an election year, an occupation without end, without a future point of termination, was not a good thing for the president, and so perhaps a bit of both played a role.
So the accelerator's going down. George Packer, Bill Evers, stand by. We're talking tonight about Iraq, looking forward to the handover and asking, with 100,000-plus U.S. troops still on the ground, can June's scheduled transfer of power be for real? Is it going to work in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting under the covers in Iraq this hour, asking what's really going on there. Just 5 months before the scheduled handover of sovereignty to the Iraqis, my guest tonight, Bill Evers. He was senior advisor for education to Ambassador Paul Bremer from July through December of last year. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. And from New York City, George Packer, writer for the New Yorker magazine. His article in November was War After War, What Washington Doesn't See in Iraq. You can join our conversation as well. Might President Bush yet be able to credibly claim mission accomplished before the November presidential elections in the United States? Is Iraq a mess, or is it emerging into a new day? Is freedom beginning to look more tidy in Iraq or less? And what would persuade you that Iraq is really on the mend? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. I had several points, but one, the first is when Vice President Cheney lectures us and says that, some people think democracy, some people are not fit for democracy. It is he who shows an underappreciation of how many centuries and how many political and other kinds of thinkers it took to develop in Western civilization the political system and the checks on power that we did develop, and the notion that this can somehow be imposed in an area of the world where, when you come right down to it, even the secularists are affected by the attitudes and the tenets of Islam, so that the principles of the Sharia, which
Islamic law. So, Peter, are you saying then that Iraq, are you writing it off? You're saying it's not fit for democracy?
I'm saying it may be someday, but it's not. But any place that ultimately has a majority of the population respecting the Sharia, which does not allow for freedom of conscience in the first place.
Well, I mean that's an interpretation. There are clearly other countries that have both religious tenets at work and secular democracies at the same time. Iraq wouldn't be alone in that.
Well, Turkey alone among Muslim states, for example, permits people to be apostates. You cannot be an apostate without a fear of your life or at least losing your job and being publicly disgraced.
So you're going to this right to this issue of whether an Islamic country can emerge and whether Iraq can emerge as a democracy given that tradition and that history.
I think it's a utopian project, and it is a distracting project from the much greater problem. If we persist in calling this a war on terrorism instead of a defense against a worldwide jihad, we will be distracted by Iraq. We have already gotten rid of a terrible regime and disarmed it. That's fine. We owe the Iraqis exactly nothing.
Oh, it's a tough line, Peter. Let my guest pick it up, and thank you for your call. Bill Evers, how about it? Peter is very skeptical of democracy in Iraq. On the other hand, I was talking with a friend who's done a lot of business there over the years who said he thought this was the most likely candidate for democratic development in the Middle East. What's your sense, having spent some time there?
Well, I think it's a reasonable candidate. As I was saying earlier, though, as the Syrians move out of Lebanon, mm-hmm. as Lebanon comes back on track, it's also a country that's in reasonable shape in terms of a constitutional democracy. I think, you know, getting back to an earlier question, which had to do with how much elections are figuring in this and how far along we really are, I think that, in a sense, the ministries turned out, once they were in Iraqi hands beginning last September, to doing pretty well. A reason to think that electoral considerations are not making a big portion of this decision.
That is American presidential electoral expectations.
Originally, Bremer was thinking he was going to be running things beyond June 30th and beyond the election.
Mm-hmm.
It was really both Iraqi success and Iraqi agitation to be taking on more responsibility.
Of course, there was
really
American agitation as well to the big
surely,
pressure last fall to get those troops home, to see an end at the light at the end of the tunnel.
But we want America to be a constitutional democracy, too. So it's not wrong for the president to be trying to figure out what is consistent with American values, what is consistent with the public's wishes with regard to foreign policy. That's a good thing. That's not a bad thing to have. And it's good that we have periodic elections and that there is a check on what the president and Congress are up to. So I also think, though, in terms of this last caller's question,
yes,
that there is a lot of potential in Islamic society for democracy. Now, it's true for various historical reasons. Succession of tyrants and brutal despots have been in an awful lot of these countries. But Malaysia is a pretty good democratic country. Turkey's a pretty good. They all have problems that we could spend another whole show on.
Yep.
I think Jordan is improving. I think Morocco is improving. As I've already stated, I think Lebanon is in really pretty good shape.
You don't want to paint that whole world with one brush, obviously.
No, that's right. As Mr. Packer would say, it's more complicated. I want to recommend the people of your listeners that are interested in this. There's an organization called Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, and they are a small group, but with worldwide activities, and they're in Washington, D.C., Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, and they have a website, www.islam-democracy.org, and they cover this, and they have a lot of interesting things to say about the potential within Islamic countries and particularly within Arabic Islamic countries for constitutional democracy.
We've got it. Let me get another caller here. Jackie's calling from Drummond, Wisconsin. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Yeah. I just, you know, listening to all this, it just seems like such sterile, unrealistic rhetoric. It's just, it seems so unrealistic that you could kind of foist a democracy on this country that was held together under fear for so long until you lose the generations that were, that, you know, the people that were under Saddam Hussein. And also, when you think about it, I think the normal people probably could care less about politics. They want jobs. Not too long ago, there was the, you know, people came to the U.S. looking, came to the U.S. embassy or something looking for jobs. It was a riot, and they were shot at.
In southern Iraq,
still high feeling of frustration, 50% unemployment. You know, you're not thinking democracy.
Well, are you sure, Jackie? But, I mean, after all those years of despotism, of tyranny, don't you think they might want to have something different than that?
Well, I think they want jobs. I mean, yeah, but they would, a lot of the people were employed under, you know, Saddam Hussein. I'm not agreeing at all with this, but how frustrating to not have a job and not be able to support your family.
So as an American citizen, then, if that's what you are, Jackie, does that leave you thinking it doesn't matter if the United States leaves behind a democracy or not? Just get some economic stimulus in there and get out and let the devil take the hindmost? Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm thinking get the people so they will want a democracy, meet some of their basic needs, infrastructure, hospitals, mm-hmm. salary, mm-hmm. schools, then people will probably listen to us. I bet there is really a high anger against the Americans among all people because their lives have been so disrupted.
Jackie, we've got it. Thanks for your call. George Packer, how about that? We haven't talked much about it tonight, but for months and months we heard this fundamental critique that the power wasn't on, that the water wasn't running, that there weren't jobs, that the economy wasn't restarted, that $12 billion worth of looting had gone on and destruction during the war.
And people didn't feel safe.
People didn't feel safe. They couldn't go outside without fear of being kidnapped or shot, and that all that kind of the backwash of the war was making it impossible for Iraqis really to get going again. Is that behind us now, or is that still we've just gotten used to it and don't talk about it anymore?
I think more the latter. I mean, the power still is sporadic and at 50% in some places. I think it's a chronic problem. Joblessness is an enormous problem. And all this, I think Jackie is right. All this has a big effect on the political scene, because one thing it's done is it's taken away some of the legitimacy of the American occupation. So that when America went into Iraq, there was an idea that, as you suggested, Tom, you know, the absence of Saddam would mean democracy, mm-hmm. that once Saddam was gone, people would then turn naturally to what Saddam had denied them. But that's actually not the way it usually works. When a dictator is removed, something more like chaos is what results. And that's what we saw in the early weeks in Iraq. And so there was a great deal of pie-in-the-sky thinking on the part of the Pentagon civilians in Washington, which really put people like Bill Evers and Drew Erdman, who is his counterpart in higher education and whom I wrote about, mm-hmm. in a deep hole, because the first weeks were so crucial and the first impressions were so bad that the CPA has been playing catch-up ever since. And what's happened, therefore, is its political legitimacy was in doubt from the beginning, and therefore its ability to push Iraqi politics in a secular or more moderate and more democratic direction has been compromised. And what we see now is both sides are turning to the UN to try to referee this. If the UN had been brought in a big way early on, there is some reason to think that as a neutral arbiter and as a more legitimate occupying power, it would have been able to manage the political transition without quite so much upheaval.
But it's late in the game for that now, though the U.S. is now asking ardently for the U.N. to come in and do something there.
Suddenly the U.N. looks like looks a lot better.
Maybe the savior, something like it. But where does that leave you, George Packer, looking at this now? Do you still see an infrastructure so incomplete that it's a kind of joke to imagine that Iraq might loft a successful political future off of it, and the United States is choosing to ignore that because it has its own reasons to get out? Or is it good enough that the U.S. can credibly say, here you go, here's your footing, step off?
I don't think the fact that the power is sporadic it means Iraq cannot arrive at some kind of a more decent representative government. But the relation is more indirect. When people are constantly worrying about their own personal safety, the jobs, money, and the deep discomfort of bad infrastructure and of bad utilities, it exacerbates already tense political situations. It means that the desire to cooperate and to put aside group grievances and to in a sense, get away from the zero-sum game that we talked about earlier, it just makes it all the harder to do that. It's not an insuperable barrier, but it's just exacerbated all the other political problems that we've seen, and it remains a problem. It will continue to be one. In a way, I think Iraq is going to limp along for quite a while, and we will look back upon the occupation as an interlude between the fall of Saddam and the return of sovereignty to Iraqis, as a rather disappointing interlude that was something of a lost opportunity.
But right now, limp along rather than civil war might be welcome in Washington. Nick is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm afraid I buy the grimmer scenario. Mm-hmm. I think that this whole thing was pushed by the neoconservative ideologues who are guilty of the same sort of dangerous idealism as the so best and brightest of the Vietnam era, and I don't think the outcome is going to be an appealing one, and I think that, frankly, I think that we're headed for a real disaster.
Nick, let me ask you this. Do you believe that when Paul Bremer, you know, hands over the keys to the car and flies back to Washington or Vermont or wherever he's headed, that the United States is really and truly going to be handing over sovereignty, power to Iraqis?
No, absolutely not. We're going to have over 100,000 troops still there, aren't we?
That's the plan at the moment.
They're going to be in a position where they can step in if things get out of hand. I see nothing but a mess. Sorry. I remember Vietnam only too well, and I see that Robert McNamara was interviewed by someone from The Guardian. Read it on the internet last night, and he agrees.
Still saying, watch out.
He's very, very disturbed by what he sees happening.
Nick, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. George Packer, how about it, this issue of power? We heard earlier the idea is for a super embassy to be the successor American presence to the Coalition Provisional Authority. But still, 100,000 troops or more there. Where do you see the balance of power after a June 30th formal transfer, if indeed we hit that target?
I'm not sure I see America pulling all the strings behind the scenes. I mean, we're not doing that now that when we still do have legal authority in Iraq. I'm not sure why, after we've turned sovereignty back, we're suddenly going to be manipulating things to our, you know, to our contentment. I think, in fact, it's, as I said earlier, every day since November 15th, it has been slipping further out of our control. And Iraqis are going to take their own course. We don't yet know what relation the military presence is going to have with a sovereign Iraqi government. That's something that they're presumably
Sistani wants
to
vote on
out.
That as well, whether or not they should even stay. Bill Evers, we have less than a minute left here. Do you see the United States really handing over the power that it gained at such cost in war?
I think that if this is going to be a really Iraqi run constitutional democracy, substantial power has to accompany the transfer of sovereignty in name. And that is something that I think the growth of the Iraqi army, the growth of the Iraqi police force, and the growing, I hope, maturity of Iraqis who are running the government leave you, I think, with an optimistic possibility here.
Bill Evers, with that, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Bill Evers joined us from Palo Alto, California. He was senior advisor for education to Ambassador Paul Bremer from July through December of last year. And George Packer in New York, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
George Packer with the New Yorker magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.